outline or the overview of the series of talks. If you will notice, it is outlined in terms of sessions, and we have already had sessions 1 and 2. And associated with those two sessions, the very last page in what has been handed around, I have summarized from some information from Nathan Stone's book named The Names of God to fill in some of the references I had made in the previous talks. Now, if you'll notice, the courses have sessions listed, and what I'm hoping is that now you'll be able to take these comments and scripture verses, and perhaps you might be able to do some preparation as you come, or you can take it away and do some preparation after you leave. Either way you want to do it. But the material is, especially the first part of it, is really a little thicker and slower and more abstract than is usually given, so it requires some real thought. And you might want to review those scripture references that we gave on the nature of God in himself. We have to begin from the assumption, as we are beginning, as human beings setting out in this world, we have to begin from the assumption that God is not known, that God is misunderstood, that who God is left in the dark. And in fact, that's the only way we can manage to save any reputation for him at all, is to suppose that his real nature is hidden. And then we need to work through the questions that have to do with why that is true. Now, we're centering our meditations on the first verse of the 23rd Psalm. And I'd like for you to, again this evening, to meditate on that whole psalm with me. You're welcome to repeat it, or if you wish to, just listen and think as we go through this psalm. And the first verse is the one, this very audacious claim. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all of the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This is one of those great, wonderful passages of writing which couldn't possibly have been made up. No one could have made that up. The human mind doesn't run at those kinds of heights. You know, you often see stories that are so real they could never have been made up, and these words are like that. These words express the experience of a man. A man whose life was pretty rugged, to tell you the truth. But who in the midst of that came to know the complete sufficiency of Jehovah. We've dwelt on those words. All self-sufficient, eternal, undying being. which makes personal covenants with individual human beings. And David knew that covenant and walked in the covenant. And he had seen the hand of God in his life. He knew the sufficiency in a way which it came down to simply it did not matter what else happened. There was nothing that could happen that would rob him of the sufficiency he found in the interactive relationship in which he lived with God. Absolutely nothing. And almost everything did happen, didn't it? For him. Almost everything did happen. He failed personally. Enemies were down his neck. He spent years hiding in caves. A failure. After he had known God in his life, this little boy that went out and slew Goliath, afterwards knew times of great testing. So this is a record of a personal relationship with God. And it is in that kind of relationship that life without lack is known. Now, my only purpose in dealing with this subject is so that every one of you can know that same life as fully as it can even be imagined. Because what is given here is not something that's just for a few peculiar people who are talked about in the Bible. It is an expression of God's intent for every human being. Everyone. And from the human side, the life without lack is simply a matter of having one's mind fully and constantly fixed upon God as he is. That's it. And that brings everything else that is needed with it. Having one's mind fully and constantly fixed upon God as he is in himself. And as I have said the other evening, that is why we have in the very first petition of the Lord's Prayer, "Hallowed be thy name." And Jesus revealed the name of the Father to his disciples, as he says in John 17. He revealed the name. That means he let them know who God really was. And it's interesting to see the similarity between some of David's prayers and the Lord's Prayer, which Jesus gave us. But they both knew the hand of God in their lives, and Jesus, of course, knew it in a very special way, because at his hand, water turned to wine, the blind were made to see, the raging sea calmed itself, the dead were raised, and the poor heard good news. For the first time, really. So what we're looking at then is the nature of God and how the sufficiency of the shepherd, provides the life without lack. And I've really dragged you through some pretty difficult material. I hope you've had time to meditate on it and let it come home to you. Because the point of the scriptures that we've studied and the thoughts that we have led through is simply that God is a reality which is so much greater than anything that we ordinarily see around us or come to deal with in human life. Just simply has no comparison. And yet we are faced with the fact that human beings have turned their minds away from such a God and spend all of their time practically thinking about things which frankly don't matter, rather than live in the world where there is such a God as that. So now we've got to think this evening about why there are people. And if you look at the outline, you'll see on page 2, this heading, "Why There Are People on Earth." You ever want to know the answer to that question?
Lonely.
Well, of course, we're not just interested in the abstract question, but also in the particular question, because our concern is to understand why we are here. And this is not something that was clear even to the writers of the scriptures sometimes. Perhaps we can begin this evening by just looking at Psalm 8. And then we will go back to the creation story. Psalm 8 starts out with the excellence of the name of Jehovah in all the earth. O Jehovah, our Elohim, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who hath set thy glory above the heavens. That is a verse which gives the impression of the psalmist about the nature of God and what God is in himself. He set his glory above the heavens. The heavens themselves merely reflect the glory of God. Verse 3, when I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Now then comes the assignment. Thou madest him to have dominion over the work of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, the beasts of the fields, the fowl of the air, the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passes through the paths of the sea. And then he returns to the theme, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all of the earth. What is the heart of the passage here? The heart of the passage here is the psalmist is saying, in the light of the good work you have done, in the light of the excellence of your creation, the greatness of your creation, what good is man? What good is man? Let me just set aside reference to the scripture a moment and just talk in terms we're all very familiar with. We believe that people are valuable, don't we? That's something that they even say on the newscast sometimes. Now, why are people valuable? Why are people valuable? Why are you valuable? Why are you something which ought to exist? Which it is right that others should help you exist and be what you are. Why? If you go back to the creation story, you will see a sequence of goods. And I want you to just reflect, without us working all the way through, on how often that word occurs in the scriptures here in the first and second chapters of Genesis. What is the first thing that is called good in this story? Light. Would you agree that light is good? Everyone agree that light is good? Isn't that interesting that we can all agree on that? Actually, I think light is wonderful. I think it's just wonderful. I think God did so well when he created light, don't you? I think it's one of his better inventions, actually, though the others are very good. But light is just so good. You know, you can almost drink it in with your eyes, can't you? And light isn't something simple. Light is a very complex thing. There are so many kinds of light. And then, of course, in light comes color, doesn't it? And so that's pretty good. Light's good, all right? And then we have a firmament which divides the waters, which are above the firmament, from those that are beneath it. And the firmament is simply whatever holds the water that's above you up. Now, you will recognize that there is water up there, and sometimes it falls, right? But whatever it is that holds it up there is the firmament. And God divided the waters. And you know, if it wasn't divided, we'd have a hard time, wouldn't we? Rain is good, isn't it? Isn't water good, by the way? Do you think so? Oh, water's real good, too. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together. And it was so. And then there's dry land. You like dry land? Does everyone like dry land? I like dry land. Dry land is good, too. Land is good. Water's good. Light's good. We're doing okay, aren't we? Right? Shall we say, so far, so good. And then, what do we have? Well, we have herbs, grass, fruit trees. And, guess what? Verse 12. Does anyone here like grass? Fruit trees? They good? They're good, aren't they? Well, I'm not going to carry on in that vein because I hope I've made the point. And now then we go on from vegetables and things of that sort to the sun and the moon. And those are really quite wonderful devices, you know, when you stop to think about them. Does anyone here like the sun? Do you think the sun is good? Sun's good. The moon's good, too. I like both of them, yes. I find myself just agreeing all along here with this. And then we have the living things in verse 20 and following. I like moving creatures. I think other people do. I suspect that's why they have zoos. You have zoos, what do? You go and you look at the moving creatures, don't you? And whales are in here. Those are among my favorites. The only thing I think I could actually improve on here is if it just mentioned elephants. I'm very fond of elephants. I like elephants a lot. I think they are among the really good ones. I love elephants. And verse 25 says, and God saw that it was good. Now, let's just pause a moment. You see, all of these creations are good. Being is good. Being is better than non-being. One of the most depressing thoughts you can think is just nothing. Just nothing. Occasionally, I'll get involved in a philosophical discussion with some person who, because they are caught up in their attitude about this, would suggest that it would have been better that if God had not created anything. You know, I really know that I'm dealing with someone who simply has not thought about it when I have to deal with someone like that. I know also I'm probably caught up dealing with someone who is focusing on some particularly bad thing which they don't like and which perhaps is very bad. If you think of famine and sickness and all of the sorrow and pain that is suffered by human beings in the world. But if you weigh it all out, including all the pain and the suffering, and you weigh it over against the joy and the strength that you find in human life also, it's still very, very good. And now God comes to create man, and he says, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air. So God created man in his own image and blessed him. Now, and here is the charge which was given to human beings. And this is the one which we're still working on, whether we believe in God or not. All you have to do is to look at human history from its most rudimentary form to its most complex, and you'll see that that's what human beings are doing. They forgot about God in many cases, but they're still on the project. And that's why it isn't working so well, of course. They forgot about God. But we are, in our nature, just fitted to what Jesus, or what Moses here has written down as the charge that God put on us when we were created. Look at this. Verse 28. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. There's a lot of different issues floating around in there I'm not going to dig into. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Man was put in charge of the earth. The charge of mankind was to rule the earth for good. And it was good that it should be so. Look at verse 31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. So now, you see, many people who like the things that creep and crawl around the zoo have some doubts when they come to man. And they wonder if maybe the world might not have been better if we hadn't had this little addition, man. And so that's the real challenge for this evening. It is to understand what God created when he created human beings and what is especially good about them. Man was created differently. He was created to have a special relationship to God and in that relationship to do his work. God did not stand over his shoulder, but he worked in a power that was not his own. It's a pretty big job to have dominion over the earth, isn't it? Some of us have a hard time having dominion over a 25 by 15 foot backyard. There are lots of things out there working. It's rather hard to control them. But you see, while man was in union with God in the passage in Genesis 2 here, where you have the description of a garden eastward in Eden, and man placed in it, he was placed there in his union with God. There was in man that which was of God. Here's his creation. Verse 7, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became. Now it says there, living soul, but actually it's really moving creature. It's the same word as you find earlier to refer to the whales. Man did not become a moving creature and then become a human being. It was only in conjunction with God's special creative infusion of something that was like him, spirit. You know, the breath of life in verse 7 is not the stuff around us here, okay, that we breathe in and out. He didn't make a little mud baby and get down and give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, because God doesn't breathe. He doesn't breathe. But he has spirit, and he infused a special creation with spirit. And that is what makes man unique, and that is what gives him his special value. That's what makes you unique, me unique. And in virtue of it, we are able to relate to God and participate in his government of the earth. It's so hard to lift people up to that. I can tell that probably half of you this evening don't feel like you're in the business of governing the earth. Maybe half. And it is difficult for us to adjust the terrible image that has been projected upon us by the world around us and step into the dignity of the sons and daughters of God. The number one thing that most people think they have to do is survive. That's it. And that gives them the impression of being in a very precarious position. So human life is presented as if you were just, you know, a chicken right on the edge of the roost and you're about to be knocked off any minute now. I hope that all of you can quickly call to mind enough of what Jesus said and what he did to understand that that was not the picture he projected. But here we are just clawing and scratching to survive. And that's because we have accepted an image that the world has imposed upon human beings. Rather than every human being being a special creation of spirit, living in the hands of God, as Jesus said, every child with guardian angels looking after them, every child. You remember he spoke that in a context where he was dealing with how children are put down and how it is better that a millstone would be hung around our neck and thrown into the depths of the sea than that we offend a little child. But what happens? The little child comes into the world and it's treated as anything but that, as anything but a precious, wonderful creation that God has a special care for. And one of the hardest things for us to do, I believe even as we are Christians, one of the hardest things for us to do is to keep that in our mind as we approach every human being we deal with. They don't look sometimes very precious. They're filled with hostility, perhaps. It's dangerous to be around. We hurt one another in so many ways. And I often remember there was a commercial some years ago about a lovely lady who at a social gathering would put out her hand and just as the man would take it, it would turn into a cactus. This was an advertisement for something like Jergens lotion, you know. But so often we are like that and we are guarded against one another, and so even a little child can appear as a great threat to us, a great danger. So now what I want to say to you this evening at this point is just as we have a tremendously difficult time even conceiving or imagining what God is like, so we have a tremendously difficult time imagining what we are like. And when the psalmist says, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" he is expressing that fact. He's expressing this realization that God so makes over human beings that they must be something much greater than they look like. You see. You know, I think there's a curious fact which deserves some thought, and that is we often speak of people who think too highly of themselves. But I'm rather inclined to think that I have never met a person who thought highly enough of themselves, and that that is a major part of their problem. I think one of those bits of fallen wisdom that we get is that we can really keep people, we can really help people by keeping them humble, right? Keeping them humble, we call it, which often means humiliating them. Of course, one of the things you learn before too long, if you're observant, is the sure way not to make someone humble is to humiliate them. Doesn't work that way. Just like you can't get people to be lovable by hating them, or kind by being cruel to them. So there's a whole nest of problems in how we think of ourselves. And Jesus' challenge to us, you see, when he comes we're going to deal with this at greater length in one of the subsequent sessions, and says, when he says, he that would save his life shall lose it, and he that would lose his life for my sake and the gospel shall find it. For what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Does it sink into you how precious the individual soul must be? And I'm afraid that most of us can't even really think very seriously about that, partly because of our own self-image. We can't imagine anyone giving up very much for us. I mean, if you were on the block, let's suppose, just use your imagination now, let's suppose that you were on the block and there was going to be an offer made of your worth. How much do you think others would be willing to accept for you to get lost? How much? And the fact of the matter is, in the way of this world, there aren't many of us here that could raise a very big price at an auction. If the chips were down. Now you see, Jesus wasn't dealing with that situation because he wasn't dealing with what someone else would give for us. He was dealing, in fact, with the only one who can trade us for anything. Who is that? Who is the only one that can trade you for anything? If what we've said about your nature in relationship to God is true, you are the only one. And that's the one he was talking to, you see. That's why he put it the way he did. You're the only one. What would you trade your soul for? What makes human beings so precious is that they are capable of faithfulness to God. They are capable of faithfulness to the good. They are capable of giving their lives for it, even to the point of laying down their lives literally in death. Greater love hath no man, Jesus said, than what? He that layeth down his life for his friends. Right? And yet, you see, that point at which we understand the greatness of the human soul was the very point that God used in his Son to show his love for us. You see, God commendeth his love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, yet in rebellion, Christ died for us. Life is so cheap because it is in the hands of God. Life is so valuable because of the greatness of those who give themselves up to God and for God and for everything that is good that God has made. That's what God put us here for. That's why we treasure faithfulness and loyalty and heroism in people. There's something about faithfulness and loyalty between people that is so precious and so great. And the reason why it is so good is because between people, it is emblematic of what is possible between man and God. Man's possibility, woman's possibility of giving themselves up for the glory of God and for the good which God has created and extends, you see. That's what makes human life great. And human life is on a transition. It's in a belt of time and space where we go through life with one another. And we have the opportunity of being everything that God intended us to be in relationship to God and in relationship to those around us. And we have the opportunity of creating something so precious and so good. And God is going to bring it to pass that it will happen, and if we miss our chance, we miss our chance, but He is not going to be defeated in this. He is going to create a community of loving, creative, intelligent, loyal, faithful, powerful human beings. And they are going to rule the earth. It's going to come to pass. You want to be a part of that? Just get on board. That's what it's about. When we speak of the church prevailing in human history and the gates of hell not prevailing against the church, we're talking about something real. We're not talking about a wonderful white building three stories high with large columns in front. That's not the church. The church consists of people, heroic, loving, devoted, intelligent, faithful people, faithful unto death if necessary, in the place where they are located, with the ones that God has given to them and to whom He has given themselves, to others, the reciprocal relationship of human beings to one another. In that place to know and do in all faithfulness and love what God has intended is why human beings exist and why they're so precious. Now, certainly it has to do with animals, and it has to do with plants. I wouldn't want to leave those out. That's a big part of the story. But we are put here to work. And the image of God in man is not just pure intellection. Sometimes you get the impression from hearing some people talk that God just sits around and does mathematical equations or contemplates some exalted form of truth, and that if we want to be like Him, then we'd do that too. But God is an actor. He is one who acts, who creates. His essence is not seen just in thought, but in intelligent action to create good. And we are put here, we are given a body, we are given a special place without God standing over our shoulder. Even Adam, you know, he visited him in the cool of the evening. He didn't stand over him 24 hours a day. Because God has intended that we should have an independent power in which we can choose to love Him and serve Him and give ourselves to Him, as I've said, up to the point of death itself. And the big issue for us is not always some big religious issue as we commonly think of it. It is rather to fill our hours and minutes, our actions from day to day, with the appropriate kind of love for God's creation and work to produce more of the good which He put in this world. That's every person's calling. 6 days shalt thou labor is one of the 12 commandments, you may remember, in Exodus 29. 6 days shalt thou labor. And you see, labor has been given a bad connotation, hasn't it? My brother used to say he wasn't afraid of work. He could lie right down by it and go to sleep. And many people believe work is something to be avoided. But if we do not work, our lives are wasted. And that work may be of many kinds. It includes having and raising children, the development of good personal relations, artistic creativity, political leadership, work in the church of Jesus Christ to spread the truth, building houses, running trains, are doing all of the necessary work that is available to human beings as they live together in this world to produce what is good. And of course, we often think of the higher reaches of such work, the creativity I mentioned, or the religious work. But the real challenge to every person's faith is to glorify God in the smallest actions of their days, to do everything well to the glory of God, and to give thanks to God by accepting what is put into our lives as His work materials in which we fulfill our divine calling, in which we live in eternity while we're in time. Nothing is lost of the good that we do. It is stored up in our own selves and especially in the lives of others. I want to talk just a moment now about some of the most intimate relationships that we have, because the challenge to create good and to live as God has called and appointed us to live is primarily in our most intimate of personal relationships. And it's very difficult to talk about this, because in fact this is the primary area of human failure. When Satan came to tempt mankind, he tempted them in a way which would in one blow rupture the relationship of trust between man and God, and also between man and woman. And then as soon as that was ruptured, it was soon ruptured between brothers, wasn't it? And we have our first murder. And it's a sad story to tell. The serpent sowed the seed of doubt in Eve's mind and led her to doubt God and mistrust Him and take action that was contrary to His will, to provide for herself and to, as we might say, survive. The effect of that was, as you know, that they immediately understood their position and they hid. And when God came to find them, the first thing we see is the blame placing that went on. Adam, Genesis 3, Adam, where are you? Why are you hiding? And Adam says, I was naked and I hid myself. Now, you know, we need to be a little careful here. I hope you all understand this wasn't referring just to not having clothes. God allows man to hide, and clothes are no doubt very important, but it is referring primarily, nakedness refers primarily to man's vulnerability. I like to think here that he did not see himself as naked and did not realize his vulnerability because he didn't understand, because he was surrounded by a glow of light, such as we talked about the other evening in Moses and in Jesus. And because of that glow of light of God resting upon him, he did not realize his finitude. He didn't realize where he ended and everything else began. And certainly now he did, because me, the woman. So guess who's not to blame? And in this, of course, Adam is himself doing what? He's accusing God. He's charging God with wrongdoing, you see. And of course, the woman says, well, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. And then the serpent gets the particular treatment. He doesn't. So interesting, the only one in this story that doesn't try to pass the buck is the serpent. And verse 14, he just gets the curse, and then that takes care of that. But you see the mistrust that is present here. And then, I won't read this, but in the fourth chapter, you see the same thing breaking out between Abel and Cain. Mistrust, anger, and death. What I want to say to you this evening is that the effect of the rupture between man and woman in sin has the power of making mistrust and anger and disappointment the standard quality of human life. Even among those of us who have experienced the grace of God, it is rare to find any man and woman who are married together that are truly trustful in every respect and confident and pleased and satisfied. Rather, there is a constant testing that goes on. And I can mention some dimensions of this, and I think I will, because it is such a serious problem. For example, men are usually responsible for the financial and other aspects of the life together. It's not so much true now as it was in other times. But you know, not many of us men are smart enough to really succeed well. And so the woman is nearly always in a position of thinking, well, you know, if this guy was just a little smarter, I'd be a lot better off, you know? And so it is very easy to get in the posture of doubting the judgment of the man and carrying that sort of mistrust in the midst of the relationship. Women, by contrast, for example, in our society, most of them have to live constantly with the idea that there's a real possibility they'll be traded in for something younger. You know, the man who reaches 40 and trades in a 40 for two 20s, they joke about it. But you see, that's constantly a problem. The woman, because of the meaning of looks and the basis of marriage in our society, is a constant threat and a wonder. When is the axe going to fall? Well, those are just two characteristic things in our society, but it is very difficult to find any marriage relationship which truly has the grace of God in it, to the extent that the two people involved are completely at home and confident, never in doubt, full of love and concern for one another, because the threat lies on them. And they're so busy protecting themselves that they cannot love the other. That violation there then spreads down, and children and parents have to struggle with attacks and doubts and questions that are always there. The little child, you know how the story is now quite well known, where a divorce is in a family, or death, or a parent leaves, or any of these things that are totally beyond the child's responsibility. Very often the first thing the child thinks is that I am to blame. I am the one who is responsible for that. Even if it is something that's totally out of their hands. See, that element of trust or mistrust that lies there makes it impossible for people to confidently step forward in the grace of God and realize the goodness that God intended they have in their primary work, which is their relationship to one another. Paul addresses that, of course, in Ephesians 5 with reference to men and women. He believed that the grace of God as it came in Jesus Christ was sufficient to heal the relationship between men and women. And yet it was necessary for him to teach about it. In the 5th chapter of Ephesians, you find this wonderful passage about husbands and wives, a teaching of mutual submission, and the responsibility of the husband, the responsibility of the wife. In verse 25, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Now, may I return you to the central point I was making earlier on about the calling of man is to give him or herself, because you ladies are going to be men for this purposes. You are to give yourself to the good, even up to the point of dying for it. Well, that's exactly what Paul is saying here. We are to give ourselves up. The man is to give himself up to the woman as Christ gave himself up for the church. I doubt that there are many women in the world who are able to confidently feel that they have been loved in that way by a man. Maybe some have. The pity is that many times if they have, it's impossible for them to be confident about it, many times because of their own lack of appropriate image, so that it's quite beside the point whether the man loves the woman that way or not. It would be impossible for them to be confident about it and know it. See, those acids of doubt and mistrust about ourselves come in. And of course, you know how one of the games that we play in love relationships is trying to get the other person to prove to me that she loves me or he loves me. And of course, that's always directed at a completely neurotic feeling of worthlessness. So all of those feelings and problems are there, that he might present it to himself a glorious church. The man is to think of the woman in that way, something that she would be glorious, and he would help her to be glorious, and she also would think in the same way. It almost makes your heart break with grief as you think about the way human relationships actually go and how far they fall short of this. You see, I'm using this to illustrate why there are people. There are people because in the realization of such relationships, epitomized in Jesus' own life and death, for those whom he loved and served, there is given the greatest value in all of the created universe, for which God was willing to send his own son in death that he might secure it. Just a little added emphasis here from 1 Peter, and in your reading now you have these verses and many more, so you can study them in your own time. This also on the relationship of wives and husbands. This is telling in verse 3 how to be beautiful. A beautiful woman, verse 3. Whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of the plaiting of the hair and wearing of gold or putting on of apparel. I heard a figure today that $30 billion a year are spent by women on their hair in the United States. And it really doesn't work, I think, for the purposes they are hoping that it might work, but what are you going to do? They often look very pretty, but the thing is, it won't bring you love and security, will it? If you've got your hair coiffed just right. You know, some guy's going to walk up and say, I want you to be my forever. Right? No, I don't know of it happening. But those are the illusions. I want to talk about that sort of thing next time when I deal with why there is such terrible lack or evil in the world now. But listen to this. Let it be the hidden person of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit. Now, I don't have time this evening to take the bad senses off of meek and quiet spirit. It needs some help, but it doesn't mean what it might suggest to it. It means a confident and powerful person who has enough faith and love in herself that she can be quiet, that she doesn't have to be pushy, because of the power that is in her. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. And again, don't believe what that subjection means, what you might think it was if you heard certain preachers today. Likewise, ye husbands, verse 7, dwell with the wife according to knowledge. See, that means look, dwell with the wife in understanding what is best. Don't be foolish. Be knowledgeable about what is good and right in this relationship. Giving honor unto the wife as unto the physically weaker vessel and as being heirs together of the grace of life. Now note this clause, that your prayers be not hindered. You see, the union of man and wife is a condition of an effective relationship to God, where people are married. Because if that relationship is right, see, being right in personal relationships is not something you can turn on selectively. See, it isn't like a spigot where you say, well, here comes this person, so I'll turn it on, and here comes this other person, I'll turn it off. It's like forgiveness. You remember Jesus said that unless you forgive, you won't be forgiven. And that's because forgiveness is a special kind of relationship, which if you don't dwell in it fully, you can't dwell in it at all. You can't receive forgiveness if you don't give forgiveness, because you will never understand the heart of God unless you see that mercy is to govern in all of our relationships to one another. That your prayers be not hindered. It's very difficult to pray with someone if there is trouble between you. It's very difficult to pray with a mate unless you truly love them, unless you're treating them right and they're treating you right. In fact, it's impossible. It's impossible. And I hope I don't lay a terrible burden on any of you here this evening, but if there is a problem there, the most important thing for you to do is to try to straighten it out and resume your prayers by living together in the right kind of submission and honor between you. Now, after many years of trouble, it is sometimes hard to resume that. But what we have to come back to is simply this. Marriage is a sacrament. It was never intended to succeed apart from the abundant grace of God. And we have to understand that. And we cannot enter into our marriage relationship on the basis of our own self-righteousness. We have to accept it as an expression of mercy, both from God and from our mates. And I wish I had time this evening to talk about parents and children in the same regard, but it is exactly the same way. I wish I had time to talk about neighbors and employers and all of the relationships of life, because it's exactly the same way. And the greatest thing that God is going to have to show, to show off in eternity is the fruit of the earth in the society of the redeemed. Let me read you a few words from Ephesians, and then I'll stop and we can have questions or comments if you would like. Ephesians 3. Paul is carrying on about the mystery of the Gentiles being included in the grace of God and the plan of God for the ages. And he says in verse 8, unto me who am less than the least of all saints, Ephesians 3:8, is this grace given, that I should preach among the Gentiles. And for all practical purposes, that just means everybody in the world. Right? Because there were Jews and there were Gentiles. And if you weren't a Jew, you were a Gentile. And that included everybody that we might normally think of as just an ordinary old human being. And of course, then the Jews were a small group in addition to that. Preach among the people of the world the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the world hath been hid by God, who created all things by Jesus Christ. To the intent that now unto the principalities and powers in heavenly places might be known by the church the manifold wisdom of God. That which more than anything else will display the wisdom of God throughout eternity is his people redeemed in Jesus Christ. You remember how when the sons of God came before God in the first chapter of Job, God said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? God was proud of Job. I'll tell you, he was justly proud of him, even though Job had a long way to go, it turned out. There is nothing which makes God happier than a human being redeemed by the grace of God, devoting their lives through the moments and hours of their days to the good of human beings and creation, to the glory of God. That's our privilege. That's what we're here for. That's what man is. That's why God pays attention to him. That's why God visits him. The answer to the psalmist is clear. What is man that thou art mindful of him? Just God's greatest treasure in all of his created works. Lord Jesus, let your Spirit move in our minds to help us to begin to believe it. To the honor and glory of your name we ask it. Amen. Now, what I'd like to do is to leave room for comments or questions from you, and we will stay. I'll stay as long as you want to. If you need to leave, please don't hesitate, and we'll just stay here as long as anyone wants to talk. Well, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe we'll see about that. Anyone have a comment or question? Yes. Couldn't possibly have been a contradiction, but let's... No, I'm just kidding you, Mandy. It well might have been. Yes. He didn't mean for us to sweat, to labor, to grind ourselves into the earth. He meant for us to labor. What is work? Work is the expending of energy to produce good. That's what work is. Okay? And that's what we're here for. But you see, what happened was the curse came because we broke ourselves free from the energy which would accomplish the good which we see before us. Right? We don't have the energy. We're not united enough. You see, in order for us to accomplish the good which God has set before us in our creation, we'd have to be united in love and understanding. But we're not. So what do we have to do? Sweat. Work. Grind away. And so much of it in painful isolation. You know. And the image of bringing it out of the earth by the sweat of your brow, of course, we move to the city and then we live by the sweat of someone else's brow, if at all possible. But if you're out there in the woods and there's no one else's brow around, it's your brow that sweats. So we are living in a world where we have to, according to the fallen view of things, we have to work it and grind it out on our own. And, of course, that just feeds into our isolation and our pride and our egotism and our antagonism with others. See, what basically, Cain was unhappy because his work did not get God's favor. He went out there and he raised those vegetables and all that wheat and that fruit and he brought it in, sweat of his brow, and it didn't please God. And so that created an additional problem for mankind to please God. No. And that one, we haven't succeeded with that one either. But remember that work Adam was given work in the garden. He tended the garden. He cared for it. Now, I'm inclined to believe myself that he worked in the way that Jesus did when he got ready to handle the fig tree that didn't bear fruit. You know, Jesus didn't say, "Peter, go get the chainsaw, and I'm going to take that thing down," you see. He could simply say what he wanted done with it, and it would happen. And I'm convinced that that's the way Adam worked, and that's why he didn't sweat. Thank you very much. Any other question or comment? Yes. Well, much that is called work is not the use of energy to produce good. Much that is called work, especially many jobs in a fallen world, are the expending of energy to do evil or to produce no good. So in a fallen world, we have to distinguish jobs from work. There's work, which is, as I say, the expending of energy to produce good. In order to do that, you don't have to have a job. Now, many of my students at USC now, they don't even want a job. They want a position. I know that that always involves a paycheck. I'm not sure it involves any work at all. Actually, it's a kind of it's a place. They want a place. A position, of course, means a place. They want recognition is what they want. Now, you can have a job with no recognition. So job, work, and position, I guess what I would say is that it is one of the primary things that we need to work out in our day-to-day walk with the Lord, how we're going to put those in relationship to one another. And a primary challenge for many people, for example, is to put their job in its place and recognize that their job is not their work, though it may be a part of it. Hopefully it would be a part of it. See, one of the sad things about modern life, and Karl Marx and others who have reflected upon this deeply have picked up on these truths, is that if you identify yourself and your work with your job, and if you don't have a job, you are a nobody. And that is a terrible thing to be. To not have work. So it's very important for us to understand work rightly. And it's a great challenge to our faith many times to develop our job so that it becomes a part of our work. Sometimes it means we change jobs. We take great chances even sometimes in order to have a job that relates to our work. Now, you see, there we have to guard against the romanticization of jobs, so you want a position. You see, that's an ego thing. It's an ego thing. And Jesus gave us wonderful examples about that. We'll talk some more about that later on. Because one of the things you cannot have is a life without lack that is feeding the ego. Because you know what about the ego? It always lacks. It will never be satisfied. And some of its demands are legitimate, but many of them are not. You cannot win with the ego by feeding it. And so we have to talk in one of the sessions to come about death to self, that dreadful topic, death to self, through which alone freedom can come. So these issues about jobs and work have so many ramifications. But I think it does help to begin by just drawing that distinction, especially between my work and my job. And the rewards of work are many times not monetary, possibly even not even possible of being assigned a monetary value. But still, they may be all the more important for that. It's important to keep before ourselves the range of goods which we can produce by our activities. One of the things that is most underdone in Christian circles is there is not an adequate emphasis placed upon artistic creativity in many of its forms. That not necessarily the fine arts, but even just a lovely home, hospitality, and the aesthetic qualities that go into that. And some of you are very good with that, and probably we take advantage of you because of it. Such wonderful qualities of homemaking and food and clothing and those things. That's what I'm really talking about, you see, is that sort of good that's very important for us. Jesus, I think, appreciated that. I've always, you know, it would have been so easy for him to have made wine that wasn't any good. Or was just medium good.
He made good wine, real good wine.
That's characteristic of God, to do that. And it's our calling and our opportunity to be the same way, whether we're doing a set of books as an accountant or whatever we're doing, to do it well, to put the beauty into it, to put the solidity into it. And all of his works have beauty in them, from numbers to boards, from beans to cotton cloth or whatever, have beauty in them, and it's our great challenge to be a part of his work in bringing out the good that's in them. Well, Caesar, that's a big topic, but I hope that'll give you a start. Any other comments or questions? Larry. Yes, just being a person. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, people are valuable at that level, but I don't think that's why they were put here, was just to sit and be valuable. And the reason I don't is because of the charge that is laid out in the first and second chapters of Genesis, and certainly the emphasis upon action. And I can only say that I don't think God just does nothing. He doesn't just sit and be valuable. You know, we have all these traditional conceptions of God in the theologians and metaphysicians about just someone so totally immobile, never changes. Just, that's it. And my, that isn't an apt expression to me of the greatness of God. He's a furnace of activity, spewing forth worlds of spirit and matter and going so far beyond that that we can't even imagine. And we're not going to be that productive. But thank God we're put here to make a difference. And what did he say? So let your light shine before men, that they may see what? Your good works, and glorify who? Your Father which is in heaven. Now you see, that one little verse encapsulates what I'm saying tonight about why there are people. And that is an active process. Faithfulness to one another and God in what is good. I hope that we can say some helpful things on that before March is over. But we do have to deal with that, and I've in part been dealing with it this evening even by referring to this terrible problem. But, I mean, the next time up is the main attempt to explain this. And there's a very serious problem. I don't think it has to do with just human orneriness. I think it is that we are caught in the middle of a battle. And so you have a lot of scripture verses to look into there and see what you think of, but I do want to talk about that next time. Any other comments? Yes? Yes. Thank you. Well, he's not recreating himself because he's there, but he's creating something very like himself, every one of which is an original and not a copy. I see. Are you troubled about this idea that God is kind of a cosmic egotist that wants to have people... Oh, okay. Some people are troubled by that. They think God is just creating all these people who'll stand there and say, oh, you're wonderful. I'm sorry that I'm... Yes. Well, the question of even won't arise, really, because we all will have our roles to fulfill. There's plenty of space and time to occupy us all. And so it isn't a matter of... we will be one. And you remember the prayer that Jesus prays in the 17th chapter of John is that we would be one with one another and with him. So that in our action, the effect will be an effect of oneness, of union. But it's not as if then we were somehow irreplaceable or that we were assuming to be like God or anything of that sort. But we will be one. And the unity that Bill Hamer is talking about and that the scriptures talk about is really a unity which is so great that it seems almost presumptuous, and I'm still not sure I'm getting the point you're after, but it does seem presumptuous, but the fact is that God has so created us that we can and are destined to assume that role. And in the New Testament, that is put in terms of children, being the children of God. Let me read you one verse to just cap that off from 1 John. And 1 John is the maturest reflections of this old brother who, by the way, Dean Jones has recently produced a video called John on Patmos, which is just wonderful if you get a chance to see it. It's a kind of, it's one of these one-man shows, you know, that they do sometimes. Wonderfully done. Here's what he says in 1 John 3. Beloved, verse 2, beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And that continues John's emphasis upon how the mind and knowing brings us eternal life and changes us, but also reflects that he doesn't yet have any idea of what this is going to be like. So it's something that a lot of details are yet lacking on, and we're given glimpses about the saints judging the earth and being a part of a family and sharing the throne in the sense of the power and direction of things with Jesus. But you do need some good science fiction to kind of help you even imagine what this is going to be like. Right? And I think that's I think that science fiction, by the way, is one of God's tools for helping us imagine what might possibly happen with humanity in the future. Because we don't have many tools for it, and it is very mysterious from the strictest scientific point of view what the universe as a whole is like. Any further comment? That's a big issue. All right, I think I see a few sleepy people, so we'd better quit. Thank you very much for your attendance, and I hope you will have a blessed week.